Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the smoothest glass of Amarula for your mind, Two Crickets in a Thorn Tree. I am half of your hosts, Mr. Nicholas Lorimer, joined as ever by the other half of your hosts,
Gabriel Krauser.
How to do.
And, yeah, today we are recording in the morning, which is an unnatural and unholy time. I don't like mornings. I'm not a morning person. And so I apologize in advance if we seem discombobulated. I think both of us are feeling the weekend feeling. But
Crickets are supposed to chirp around sunset
at night,
or
right, exactly,
in the deep night. Yeah,
exactly. This is just unnatural. But regardless, we will soldier on ahead and try to keep it to around an hour this time, because I think our last two episodes have been an hour and a half each. Which is,
they were great special editions.
They were, sort of. I agree. But, man, there was a lot. So you have a hypothesis, and I think we've sort of brushed on this at various points over the past couple of months, but it's worth considering in depth, and that is the Rummer Fuhrer hypothesis. Is that correct?
That is correct. So yeah, I went to high school with Ramaphosa's second son, and he was just known as Rummer. That's what everyone called him. And I remember in high school discussing what we would call Ramaphosa if he became president. And we wondered whether we would just, the country would just call him Rama, because Ramaphosa is a bit too long for like headlines or catchiness. And as it turns out, the president came to be known as Ramaphoria, or the words around him. You know, people have played a lot with that name. But Rummer Fuhrer, it kind of, I think, just poetically fits so well that it's worth discussing. Right. The hypothesis is that that Ramaphosa becomes something like a president for life, that constitutional democracy erodes in the name of pragmatic stability, unity, maybe some business go forward. And that in a lot of ways, this is disturbing, and in a lot of ways, it's quite welcome. And the contemporary analogs would be something like Paul Kagame in Rwanda, or Vladimir Putin in Russia. So not autocrats in the full sense of, you know, Chinese Communist Party, one party state, illegal political opposition explicitly, but something like a de facto autocrat in which opposition and journalism is undermined.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe you could make that case that Rwanda is that, though. I mean, I think there's a lot of, we don't hear much about Rwandan opposition parties unless their leaders are being killed in foreign countries. At least in Russia, we hear about protests.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so it's a grayscale, right?
Right.
There are sharp lines between autocracy and democracy, but those sharp lines kind of divide not just the, you know, one extreme for the other. They also kind of divide these ladder steps in between. And I think part of the reason that this is a good time to consider the Rummer Fuhrer hypothesis is the growing pushback narrative regarding the mid-July riots unrest, which is that there was this, you know, dozen secret plotters who were in charge of a kind of ethnic mobilization project, who want to take over the union buildings and do so by making the country ungovernable, basically set up the ANC-NEC to vote Ramaphosa out through some kind of motion of no confidence and have him replaced with someone else. That's been the sort of narrative that's been created about what happened a couple of weeks ago, and then as a result, what you need is, yes, and as a result, what you need is the president to be empowered to do all kinds of things, not just send in the army to put down mobs that are burning and pillaging, but also to kind of purge, kind of, you know, it seems like a, you know, your freedom of speech, you know, it is, it's, there is such a thing as incitement to violence, and that should not be allowed. But then there's also such a thing as like saying that people need to hit the streets because we don't like what's going on here. And, you know, it is just clearly reasonable. Some people in the Constitutional Court thought that Zuma should not have been arrested. So I think they're wrong. But anyone who just complains about that and says we should go and do a protest about that, if you make that illegal, you're setting a very terrible precedent. Even worse precedent set by the police going into people's homes and saying, hey, you've got a TV. Where's the receipt for that? If you can't produce a receipt, then it gets confiscated. If someone came into where I live, I wouldn't have a receipt for, I mean, I don't have a TV, but I don't have a receipt for any of the
stuff that I do have. Right, yeah, it's not the way that things should be done, ideally.
And yet, not a lot of complaints about that. You know, so anyway, in terms of pushing back on the riots, it does seem like precedents are potentially being set for subverting due process in the name of stability, hard crackdowns. That freedom of speech and the demand that police may only enter your private space if they have a warrant, your private property is yours unless it can be proven otherwise.
In an as of yet unpublished article I wrote, these are the norms that sort of hold democracy together, the like expectations of just how things are done. And when you have a dramatic event like this, the potential for them to be eroded is quite serious. So, you know, when there's a riot and when you have to suddenly have civilians doing things and the police searching houses without warrants and all that kind of thing, it seems okay in the moment. And then that makes it easier for it to happen again in the future. Because, you know, well, we did it last time and it wasn't too bad. Why can't we do it again? And by such cuts that such small little cuts that you move from a society where democracy is the only thing imaginable to a society where, well, you know, maybe we should consider some alternatives. I see Gabriel is currently dancing around his bedroom. I'm not entirely sure why.
Yeah. And I just saw that my laptop, much like our constitutional norms, was showing very low battery. And so I was trying to plug it in.
That's very important.
So I
don't think I could hold
it. So I think that's right. And the right. I think the riots are not the only thing, and these sort of police and army campdowns. I think the other side of this is the election, and I've been talking a lot about this on Daily French shows, and we discussed a little bit on Two Crickets last week. So I won't go into that too much again, but basically, something to bear in mind is that Afrobarometer, firstly, its polling data this week shows that over 50% of South Africans are vaccine hesitant. So the idea of waiting until we reach community immunity because 80%, 70% of the country gets vaccinated, even 2/3, whatever. That idea is very worrying in terms of its plausibility being undermined by the available
evidence. It ain't never going to happen.
It ain't never going to happen. And one should be clear, the chairperson of the IEC, Glenn Mashini, and the IEC report authored by Dikgang Moseneke, they both make this claim that as long as you haven't reached community immunity, it'll always be better and safer to have one more vaccine. And Glenn Mashini said it's a precondition of having an election that mass vaccination has already taken place. And he doesn't exactly define what that means. But the argument, undefined as it is just as open to be used in February as it is now. And that means if you get one postponement, you get another one, you get another. Okay. So the point is, Afrobarometer also showed previously, I think 2019, 2018, that 2/3 of South Africans were willing to give up democracy if it meant more jobs. So yes, that's a worry. And I think that partly explains why.
Feel too good.
I think that's partly why the election issue hasn't become like a super big deal. Like in America, Donald Trump in 2020, before any vaccines, he was like, guys, maybe we should have the election a little bit later. And it was pretty clear that, you know, this, the same kind of fundamentals were in play, both biologically and politically. If the election could be postponed, without that being blamed on the incumbent, if they could somehow make it seem like an independent decision, then probably the incumbent would have stood a better chance at the elections because they were going through a tough time economically. There'd been all these riots and unrest, which showed discontent with the status quo. So if you could buy a year between that, get some stability going, get the economy going again, that would improve the odds. I don't know if it would change the outcome, but it would improve the odds. Here again, I don't know that it'll change the outcome, but I can see why, I can clearly see what the political equation is. Anyway, so in America, just the thought of that postponement of an election
elicited utter outrage.
Yeah.
People were,
and Americans
people
really like some of the op-eds
saying this is the beginning of the fascist coup. It's the end of democracy. Donald Trump is finally fulfilling his destiny that we predicted he's always going to do, which is to become an autocrat. And the idea never really went anywhere.
And by the way, those op-eds weren't just coming from Democrats. A lot of them were coming from people who support the Republican Party. So here's the thing about the Ramaphosa hypothesis and the sort of point about autocracy in general is that I think it's a mistake it's a kind of historical mistake to think that autocracy is the accomplishment of one man. There's something about Roman history which I don't want to make too much of, but Nick will correct me if I'm wrong. By convention, once Rome stopped being a democracy in the sense that it had an autocrat who was in charge and the Senate just played a kind of oversight role, the convention of appointing a Caesar was that the Senate would say, we want you to be Caesar. We want you to have full control. And then the response would be, from Tiberius, Augustus, all these guys, they'd say, no, I can't do that. That's very dangerous. You must have consensual form of government.
Yeah.
Then they say, no, but we really need you because there's this particular crisis. And like, we agree with you in an ideal state, we would have a consensual form of government. But right now, we need you to take charge. Then the guy would have to say a second time, no, listen to me. I can't do this. I'm not a good enough person to do this. No one is good enough to do this. This is crazy. And I've got many flaws and some people say that I'm too this and some people say that I'm too that. And, I don't say that any of them are right, but I must admit that I'm not a perfect person. And please don't give me this heavy, heavy responsibility. And then they say, no, a third time, but we really want you to please don't make us do this democracy thing because it's exhausting and it's distracting and then we fight with each other and, it's a terrible crisis that we've got right now. The grain situation in Egypt's not very good, or the barbarians up in the north are making us very worried, or there's this new religion sort of peasant revolution thing going on. And, it'd be very nice to do what you say and to just keep a democratic form of government. But just this once, we're asking you a third time. Please, will you put on the crown and rule us like serfs? And then on the third time, you say, "Okay, you've got me. I'll do it."
Yeah, no, you've twisted my arm enough. Sometimes it would be even more devilish than that. The candidate for emperor would say that the troops of his legion, because it was almost always a general, had spontaneously, without any pre-planning, just declared him emperor, and he was scared to deny them because they might even kill him if he refused. So yeah. To protect himself, he had to. He had no choice. No, you couldn't do anything except assume full power over the lives of every single individual. I just want to also make the point that to get to that state, it didn't happen. They didn't just suddenly decide on a system like this. They first had a case where a dictator took over and punished his political enemies with violence. And then he gave up power and he said, okay, guys, no, that was just an emergency. It's over. We're back to normal.
One off, no precedent set. We'll never do it again.
Exactly. Then it happened again. And then it happened again. And then again. And again. And it just became the norm. And in the end, I think it was about a century or two after the first emperor, the Senate meets and they actually, there's no person breathing down their necks, forcing them to become, to pick an emperor. And they go, well, you know, we could restore the Republic. But like, ooh, we can't do that. No one does that. Yeah, we'll just find an emperor. And so they did.
Because it became, the alternative became unimaginable.
Yes, exactly.
And so the point that I'm trying to bring out, and it, you know, the history is complicated. And in some cases, the aspirant emperors really were Machiavellian characters whose speeches, oh no, I don't want this, were complete nonsense. It was just convention. And sometimes it is a little bit more earnest, but always the point is, always there was some kind of popular call, some kind of urgent demand that democracy be subverted.
To think of a more recent example. Turkey's President Erdogan, he's not quite an autocrat, but he's not quite a democrat either. But he became much more of an autocrat after a coup against him. And the call became, and the population, in order to show the people trying to pull off the coup and subvert democracy, you need to fall in behind Erdogan and support the regime. In fact, that was such a big factor in enhancing Erdogan's power in recent years that some people believe that he himself set up the coup to make sure that he had something to boost his popularity. Right.
And so what I'm trying to say, I think what these historical and contemporary reflections indicate, and I think similar remarks could be made about Kagame, is that the Ramaphosa hypothesis is not a hypothesis centrally, primarily about Ramaphosa, Cyril, the individual, his psychology, his aspirations, his dispositional capacities. It's a hypothesis about South Africa. It's a hypothesis about South Africa being in this position where the anointed and much of the distracted working classes and unemployed classes and so on find themselves in a position where they are more and more eager for, for big man leadership. And he just happens to be the person in that position. And maybe he doesn't just happen to be there. Maybe he's got a more active or less active hand. I'm not sure. I don't have much detail about that. But precisely the central thesis in the Ramaphosa hypothesis is that it's the state of the nation rather than the person who makes the state of the nation address, which will render this hypothesis either viable and plausible or even true or ridiculous or silly or a far stretch. So this is really not a discussion about one man. It's a discussion about one nation and whether we're in that place. And I think that I want to share a sort of anecdote about another nation, about Russia, that came back to my mind. So around 2012, 2013, I was in an awkward social space in Princeton where I had been disallowed from writing my final mathematics exam and by a professor who said, you're too good to be in this class anyway. So I stopped coming to the class and thought I'll just write the final exam. And then he said, no, you can't write the final exam because you don't have attendance, sufficient attendance to write this. And I was like, dude, come on, this is maths. You don't need attendance for maths. You just need to pass the test. And he was like, no, check the rules. So I had to do, so I failed and I had to do an extra semester. And I was truly humiliated. I still feel a bit of a blush admitting this. Now, anyway, it meant that all of my peers had already graduated, and I graduated with them, and the dean was sort of like, you know, we tried convincing this guy that he should let you through, but we couldn't convince him, and it is the professor's right ultimately to make this decision. So you can graduate with your class, but you do have to come back and make up this class. So I'd have to go back from New York every week and catch a couple of classes, and then I'd be sitting there in Princeton from Tuesday to Thursday, kind of feeling most weeks too awkward to go out and hang out at the eating clubs, which is where the students go and drink at night. So instead I'd go to the bars or graduate students. And when you go drinking in the same bar every night, you kind of learn some things. For example, that on Tuesdays they had open mic night where a group of Russian physicists, young professors, would drink. And because Russian men don't weep, they would pull out their electric guitars and let the guitars weep on their behalf through songs by Leningrad and Delfin and other kind of early capitalists. You know, Russia was so miserable in the 90s, it really produced like a very depressing kind of variation on Nirvana sound. And I slowly befriended these guys. You know, I heard them talking Russian, and the second night I sort of dropped a little Russian, hey guys, bye bye. And then the third time they were like, hey, come hang out with us, tell us your story, why do you speak Russian? I'm South African. They were really fond of that. And then I spent like three nights drinking with them before I finally popped the, I waited until the third date, before making my move. And I said, guys, now we need to talk about politics. Why does your country love Putin?
Right.
They all went quiet and they looked at each other as if they all know the answer, but they were sort of pondering who should be the one to deliver it. And then the lead guitarist, great astrophysicist, he said, because Russia needs a tsar. And he is the tsar now. And we kind of laughed and we discussed that. And the interesting sort of polling point was that there's an inverse relationship between Putin's popularity and the popularity of government. The less popular right. government is, especially local government, the more popular the Tsar is, because the sort of common man's thought is that the Tsar is the person who saves you from the government. The Tsar is effectively the leader of the opposition.
Right. So this reminds me of a Jewish joke that kind of fits in here, is that there's a legend that when Jews were being pogromed in Russia during the Tsarist years, when they were being attacked by the local community or the government or persecuted for their religion, they would say, if only the Tsar knew, he would protect us.
Exactly. And this is such a South African problem, right? Like the worse the government does, the better it is for the leader of the opposition.
That was Ramaphosa. In the 2019 election, that was essentially the sort of, I guess we could call it the Peter Bruce argument.
Yes.
Was you need to elect Ramaphosa and vote for him so that he can defeat the people inside his own party.
And vote for the party Park,
with the bad guys.
Yeah. And this is the UP's argument in Russia. And I was in Emerentia Park last weekend and I bumped into some wealthy types who reside in Westcliff. And I said, how are you guys doing? What do you think about these riots? And they thought it was very terrible. We must delay the election. And you must register to vote and you must vote for the ANC. Because even if it's just at municipal level, you have to show support for Ramaphosa right now. And I wanted to jump into the lake in Emerentia Park, but
It was too cold. So I these are real human beings that I've known my whole life, and I really like them. They're generally very smart and wonderful people. So, you know, this is not just a matter of like lacking an education that's formal or whatever. You know, this is a line that human beings, we just belong to a species. We are what we are. And these are psychological tropes that repeat themselves across time and space. And anyway, so this is the kind of thing we were discussing with these Russians. And then we carried on drinking, and these guys had complained about their family lives and like how they missed Russia and they moved to America, and they found Americans to be sort of like a nation of children who don't cover their noses when they sneeze and are very earnest and poorly mannered and sort of crass. And they much preferred the kind of Russian reserve and the deep wells of poetic and musical traditions that are drawn from there. But they said they have to leave. And I said, so why do you have to leave? And they said, well, because we watched an entire nation fall in love with one man. And they said, at first, it was the most fascinating, frustrating, interesting, debatable thing. And it was always like, you know, do we really love him? Does he really love us? Are we just using each other for the this or the that? Is it just like a rebound thing, but it's not real? Like
all toxic relationships, yeah.
and then they said, you know, and for them, it got to the point where they realized we are in love, even if you say that you're not in love, because we just keep talking about him. We keep worrying and wondering and discussing and ooh and ah. It's just like an obsession. We clearly are falling in love. And then the first guy said again, but the truly terrifying thing, the terrifying thing is when we realized this is true love. That is when it became dark. True love is when you realize he is the one. And then the next guy said, true love, it means he is the one and only. And then the third guy said, true love, it means this, he is the one and the only one. And I could feel, I felt like a cat in a room with no windows. And I understood, you know, there is something about true love, that in true love, you can get angry with each other. You can be happy with each other. You can be frustrated with each other, but this is the one and only one. And I think it's that kind of mood, that kind of affect, which is so valuable and important, that is enshrined in the vows of like every major religion when you get married.
Right.
That, you know, this is clearly something that all kinds of people, you know, we all fall in love if we're at all lucky. But there's something really weird about when a whole nation falls in love. And the Ramaphura hypothesis, again, it's not about him. It's about us. It's about falling in love with this man and him being the one and only, the one and only one. And from a political science perspective, you know, Machiavelli's argument to the prince was, look, the best trick you can pull off is just to convince your people, to put your people in this position where they can't imagine an alternative. So when they're angry with you, they're going to do something. When they're happy with you, they're going to do something. When they're kind of feeling a little bit in two minds about you, they're going to do something. But what they're never going to do is try and replace you, because they can't imagine an alternative to you being in charge. And that's kind of what Zuma was speaking to when he said, with a straight face, we're going to rule until Jesus comes. And nobody laughed, you know?
Yes.
This is the kind of true love that I have a serious emotional connection with, because I grew up loving the ANC. Mandela was the hero, and the ANC was this grand liberation party, and falling out of love was not just a rational process. It really was a profoundly emotional thing. And a lot of it did at the beginning,
one of the things about true love is when you are truly in love and the, some scantily clad you know, bombshell strolls past and your thoughts wander, you kind of chastise yourself for imagining a deviation. There's something noble and honorable about sticking to the line, even if it's not really working. And that is, when I was like fully in love with the ANC, that is what it felt like to imagine voting for another party. The only way, literally, like a lover, you know, there's this classic lover's problem where, okay, something's not going well in the relationship, so you and someone else flirts with you, and you think about having an affair, and then you justify, you're like, well, here's what I want to do. I want to have this affair in a way to punish my lover.
Right.
To show her that she's not behaving the way that she should behave, and this is what you get. So that's exactly how I felt about voting for an opposition party when I was a teenager and in my 20s. I thought, if I've got any reason to vote for the DA or the DP or whatever, it's to kind of teach the ANC a lesson that they must, you know, show me that they love me back as hard as I love them.
So
I'm gonna cheat on the ANC. That's how I thought, man. And I think that a lot of people really do think like that. And I think that it's in those conditions that the Ramaphora hypothesis seems like it makes a bit of sense. But you were, I think, I don't know, Nick, help me out here. Push back against this. Am I?
Yeah. So I mean, you say that it's not just about the man, that it's about the people, the population, right? And you know, that if the people demand that Ramaphosa becomes a dictator, he will become a dictator or an autocrat or something like that. But I do think that it does take two to tango. Not everyone can be a dictator. I could not be a dictator. As much as I may sit and dream of wielding supreme executive power and crushing my enemies beneath my iron heel, I don't think I really have the skill set for it. And crucially, I also don't project the right image. So look at every single autocrat. And a part of the way they manipulate their population is they project a sort of heroic Atlas-like image, right? They're struggling under some sort of great weight. So Putin he's holding back the West and NATO, and at the same time, he's holding back the demons within his own government. And he's really, really, really strong. He's the strongest man in the world, but even he is suffering under the strain. And poor Kagame is, you know, struggling to rescue his nation from poverty and also defeat the genocide deniers, as his regime calls their enemies.
Yeah, and resist the sort of Europeans that would rather sort of perpetually yoke Rwanda under the weight of paternalistic charity. You chased away the French.
Exactly.
Kind of,
So for that, you need to give off that aura of strength. And Ramaphosa, he does cuddly well. He's very good at looking cuddly and friendly and likable on camera, and you know, there's a particular sort of middle class person who I think really digs that side of him because he just seems so likable. Even some of our colleagues who really don't like Ramaphosa's government policies or anything really about him find him likable. But he just seems like too much of a wet noodle to ever really be able to turn his image into one that projects incredible, firm strength. That's just the feeling I get about him. You know, whenever there's a crisis, what's his preferred method of dealing with it? It's just to not be there. He just disappears like mist in the wind. And while I think in the current place that we're in and the way that the current media environment works, it's actually very clever politically, I think that is a habit that he would need to shake because, you know, Putin wouldn't disappear in the wind. At least he wouldn't want people to think that he had when a crisis happened. And I just can't imagine that Ramaphosa would be the kind of personality who would be able to do that. Now, to be fair, I think the important part about the Ramaphosa hypothesis is that, or the Ramaphura hypothesis rather, is not necessarily that Ramaphosa could rule the country like an autocrat, but that he might so lay the groundwork that his anointed heir would be able to. And perhaps that heir might be someone who is more of the right disposition. What do you make of that?
So, well, let me push back by saying that I'm not sure I agree with the premise. In other words, I think Ramaphosa does give off this cuddly affect pretty well. But I think that a lot of his supporters and a lot of South Africans have a sort of tacit understanding of how hypocrisy works and how duplicity works. In other words, Machiavelli's argument, for example, was that the good ruler can't possibly be a good Christian in the church's sense. It can't be full of charity and kindness and care, but might want to project that image for a while when it suits him. But really, the astute political observer will kind of know that this guy is lying and love him for it, because they know that the reason he's lying is in order to achieve the good. And as much as Ramaphosa is respected for his ability to project warmth, he has also always been respected for his ability to deceive. So from his union days, people who thought he was a great unionist thought, you know, what he's really good at doing is tricking the white monopoly capitalists into getting us more
hanging
than
themselves. You're right.
Right. And during the negotiations, like if you thought he was a good negotiator, it's precisely because you thought the skill of a good negotiator is to manipulate. When he returned to government under Jacob Zuma, there was the hot mic take of him secretly telling these old gogos in the rural heartland that if you vote for the opposition, the Boers will come back and take back the land. So, you know, there's this sense of like, you know, he'll say one thing on the camera, oh, racial unity, whatever, but he'll say another thing quietly. Likewise, the very reason that Ramaphosa's popularity came apart from Jacob Zuma's was the thought that Ramaphosa was a snake in Jacob Zuma's kraal, that he was there undermining him secretly and quietly and showing a warm and cuddly face to Jacob Zuma and saying, oh, comrades, we must stand together in public, but quietly behind the scenes, stabbing him in the back. There is no loving Ramaphosa in 2017 without thinking he's a grand manipulator and liar and quite a hard ass. And the case for Ramaphosa, the Peter Bruce argument was precisely that you need to show this guy support so that he can turn the screws on his enemies. But he needs to do that, you know, with this sort of loving glow around him. Now, add all of that background to the immediate conditions that triggered this conversation. A country in which a lot of pundits are not just sort of saying, hey, in mid-July, please send in the army to defend Moy River Plaza and warehouses that are being looted and disrupting supply chains that mean now we have to fly bread into Durban. They're also saying, you know, let's get some crackdown on social media and public expression. Let's send the army into squatter camps and townships to take people's TVs and bedside tables if they can't produce receipts. We saw a similar thing when the lockdown first started. You know, the army was making people do squats and push-ups, and Ramaphosa's from, as far as I can tell from Ipsos, Ramaphosa enjoyed a huge boost in support when this was going on, and that wasn't much dented by 50 people being killed or dying in police custody within the first few weeks of the lockdown. There is a sense in which life is quite cheap here.
Yeah, but exactly.
And in which authority is yearned for, and Ramaphosa has been at the back end of that. What does everyone want? They want him to be hard-ass and like get rid of Ace Magashule's, William Kieser, Jacob Zuma, get out the rotten apples, and slowly but surely this is happening. The more that it happens, perhaps, as was the case with Putin, who seemed, you know, kind of cuddly in his way back in the day. The more, I know it's hard to imagine, but you should go check him out in like the early 2000s. He's like
I've got this dream of New Russia and like the Soviet Union was a noble dream, but it was like, it had some false premises, and he was so keen to work with the West, and he was the nicest guy to George W. Bush. And
yes, I remember what is it that George W. Bush said about him? I looked into his soul and saw no evil.
Yeah, the opposite of Joe Biden, who said, I looked into his eyes and saw no soul. But the point that I'm trying to make is that there is a kind of autocrat who is very, as in an old Afrikaans phrase, like boer blink onder stink, shiny on top and like very dark underneath. And that's exactly what people love about this person, is that they have two natures. And I think, I mean, I don't want to name any names, but if I look inside our office, we have one leader who really is caring and kind and genteel, and perhaps in a slightly, you know, but also quite hard-ass, like when the decision needs to be made, it's like, no, okay, you here you cut. And I don't know, this just takes me back to the first, I've got some Shangaan friends and some Venda friends. And when Ramaphosa started campaigning in 2017 and became a sort of topic of around the Shisa Nyama fire conversation, one of my friends was like really keen on talking about the cultural or tribal differences of South Africa, that I don't know, that sort of a lot of white Wits types feel a very awkward mentioning. And he was like, you know, the Zulu militant thing, it's not altogether unjustified, and the Xhosa kind of like diplomatic vibe, also not entirely unjustified. The thing about vendors is when they want their enemies to go away, they just... they blow, and like dust, the enemy disappears. This is what people see in Ramaphosa, and this is why they love him. Because they think he's got this very cool attitude towards his enemies. That revenge is a dish-served cool. That he's not in a rush to turn the knife. He's not going to hastily do this thing in a way that gets him into trouble. He's going to do it slowly, like drip torture. One drop at a time, he's going to eat away at those agents of state capture and so on. And yeah, this, I'm not saying that was a correct appraisal of Ramaphosa. I'm saying that is what was seen in him. And it is the central, you know, I don't know, the sort of background idea here is that in some sense, politicians do become, or can become at least, what people see in them, even if it's not all together there in the first place. And, you know, let's look at Mugabe, because the Ramaphosa hypothesis is something like South Africa's democracy.
Can I add a little?
Mugabe was
a little
not
data
a.
Point.
Yeah.
A little data point. What ethnic group do you think the new head of the South African Defense Force is from?
Scots Irish.
No, he is in fact Venda. Which is interesting, because Vendas make up what? 2% of the population? Interesting.
Yeah, I actually looked up some Venda persons of note when Ramaphosa was talking about ethnic mobilization. I was like, well, if there is a Zulu nationalist thing going, surely, you know, Venda businesses would be targeted on the sort of pretense that it's Zulus versus the rest, including vendors who are connected with Ramaphosa, who's the most obvious target of animosity.
Right.
And whew, there's some big SOEs and banks and state departments that are like, there's definitely a disproportionate thing going on there. But none of them were targeted, yes, so I don't think
it doesn't
ethnic mobilization.
Does their rise to prominence perhaps coincide at all with Ramaphosa's ascension to power? Because I think some people might suggest there's a connection between these two things.
It's an interesting idea. So, I can't say enough to really expand on it. But I can say, you know, Robert Mugabe's reputation within ZANU, before it was ZANU PF, it was called ZANU, whatever it was as the academic, right? He gets a thick school, and he's like this super hardcore Christian. The argument made by Heidi Holland was that when leaders within the party were being assassinated or replaced by other means, the conspirators who are ambitious for power themselves would then be in this tricky spot where they're like, well, we've just plotted to, you know, the five of us have just plotted to destroy the next level up guy. And now one of us has to rise up to fill that position. But given that we know that we're all a bunch of snakes who are willing to kill within the party in order to rise, we can't really trust any of us to take that position and then not sort of kill off the rest. So who are we going to elevate? And then they'd say, well, let's elevate Mugabe because he was the guy who was not there. He was the guy who was stuck in the books and was not at the conspiracy meetings. And it's not that he had no idea. People would sort of send overtures his way and he would demur and
this happens all the time.
And do exactly what you described as opposed to having done.
This is a story of so many leaders and autocrats. I think I'm correct in saying you may know more about this than I, that originally Stalin was seen as a bit of a thug and a Georgian peasant idiot who didn't really know how to do anything. You know, he didn't really understand Marxism or theory or anything. He was a bit of a simpleton, and so, you know, he wasn't something to be feared until he had positioned himself so strongly within the party that it was very difficult to mess with them. I mean, that's why everyone thought Trotsky was obviously the next leader, right?
Yeah, if you were worried about Napoleon, so here's the opposite of the Ramaphosa hypothesis, career of Winston Churchill, where you have an individual that shapes their society. Someone who really, by force of will, ingenuity of charm, character, and logistics, manages to make such a difference that the society comes out other than it would have been. And the thought was, the great worry in the early Soviet Union was that Trotsky would be Russia's Napoleon, and that he would make it all about himself, and that he would be shaping society in his image. And in seeking out someone who couldn't do that, someone who would be shaped by society, they found Stalin. And the tragedy is they found someone who was the perfect kind of sort of wet clay, whose hardened form was the essence of the Marxist ideology. He really, you know, that ideology said that, look, heaven on earth is so great that there's no price not worth paying.
Right.
And he then paid that price again and again in blood. So Mugabe, I really do. I mean, I've read some shorter biographical attempts. The only full scale biography of Mugabe that I've read is Heidi Holland's. But the case that she makes is very much that he is shaped by the society that he's born into. And that if he had, you know, if Zimbabwe had been different, he would have come out differently. And that, you know, that his wife's influence was very telling when she died and when he started cheating on her and fell in with Grace, that changed things. But more than that, his sort of party surroundings were instrumental in making him into the kind of dictator that he was. And by the way, he was not super present. He was not racing out to be in the thick of things. Again, this critique of Ramaphosa being a little bit aloof and distant. What kept Mugabe going in so many ways was his aloofness, was his distance, and the fact that he didn't really see the consequences of the policies he was administering. Was that he kept thinking things are going well. Now, I don't know who more than Ramaphosa could be deluded into believing that South Africa is actually doing well by way of not
seeing what the hell is going on and just being told by ambitious apparatchiks that it's working and you mustn't trust these Americans or Brits or Russians or whoever. Anyone who says that it's not working is just some kind of insurrectionary. And if you do want to psychologize this thing, none of us really know what's been going through Ramaphosa's mind in the last little while. But I don't think it's implausible to suppose that he believes that there has been made against his presidency and that this might plant the sort of fruitful seed of paranoia in his mind.
Mm.
And paranoia is really the mood that you have to live inside for a while in order to become an autocrat.
Yes.
That's the only thing I really want to say about his psychology is that insofar as he is capable of sustaining the Ramaphosa hypothesis, it would be through paranoia and a paranoia, you know, watered or planted by a series of riots. It's worth remembering that have been more lethal than the Sharpeville massacre and the Soweto massacre combined, and the Marikana massacre combined. This really has been a deadly and traumatizing experience. And as much as, you know, the ordinary South African feels disturbed by what they've seen out their window, or what they've seen on TV, if you thought this was all about you, that would do something to you. You know, if you took this personally, if you thought the whole thing was about you, and what Ramaphosa has said in his letters and what he said in his national address suggests to me that he thinks this was all about him.
You may well be right.
All right. So what do you do if you want to disprove the Ramaphosa hypothesis? You must fight to let us vote. And then the ANC drops below 50%, a very psychological watershed in the municipal elections. And give people, you know, we all have these mutually conflicting, annihilating ideas that sit in our minds at the same time because we are moody and irrational creatures. And so the supermajority of South Africans think democracy is not that great, jobs are great, but also a supermajority of South Africans think BEE is not so great, a tax voucher-based system would be great, the ANC is corrupt, 90% of us think the country is going in the wrong direction, a lot of blame against the ANC for scapegoating its own failures and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, with the right moves being made in the public square and individuals making the right choices, I do think that that one of those syllogisms could beat the other, and that we could sort of come out of this in a slightly more American type position where we just think hell's teeth, the vote really matters, even though you can't eat it, because everything that comes downstream of that. Short of that happening, you know, in 10 years' time, you can give me a phone call and tell me what you think about the Ramaphosa hypothesis then.
Yes, it's exactly the kind of thing that one is very happy to be wrong about. Okay.
Absolutely.
With that said, let's close up now, do some recommendations so that we can actually finish at an hour. Have you got anything to recommend?
You kick us off, Nick.
You see, this is unfair because I was hoping that you would have something. So I'm going to go with something a little bit unorthodox. I have no idea how many, if any, of our listeners play video games, but I will suggest if you do. There is a very complicated, difficult, independently made game called Project Zomboid, which attempts better than any other piece of media I've ever seen to depict the zombie apocalypse. And in terms of atmosphere and making you think about, you know, how society actually sort of works and how much we depend on it, I think it's really fun. and really useful. I've had a lot of fun playing it recently, especially with friends. And also, it's made me think a little bit about buying more canned food.
I always wonder about. Go ahead. I wonder about zombies because in the philosophical literature, a zombie is just something which is as close to a person as it can be, consistent with the claim that there's nothing it's like to be that. So to give a sense of what I mean, when I look at a rock is an object that can be encountered in space and time. You can weigh a rock. It has various properties, both emergent and reductive. But there's nothing it's like to be a rock. There's something it's like to be a dog or a bat, and I might know some things about what it's like to be a dog or a bat. There're certainly a lot of things I don't know about what it's like to be a dog or a bat, but there's something like a subjective experience, what I like to call there are pea sheets lighting up. So the taste of lemon.
That is great.
I think it might be pretty awesome. Like when I was a teenager, I used to close my eyes and make a click sound. And do it close to walls and far away from walls and in open spaces to see if I could hear the difference, because my grandfather was blind and I'd seen a documentary about how some blind people used clicks to kind of navigate space a little bit. And I got to the point where I could sort of reliably tell the difference between being pretty close to a wall and being in an open space. And bats obviously have a lot more of that. But anyway, the point is that there's something that it's like, right? To smell lemon zest or freshly cut grass or see the color yellow or whatever. There's something that it's like, whereas there's nothing that it's like for a rock to encounter the sun. There's no subjective experience there. So zombies are thought to be just those kinds of things as close to persons as possible. There's nothing that it's like to be. And so this gets played out in two ways in movies, right? The one is the zombies that are, maybe they have subjective experiences, maybe not, but they're like slow and they can't talk and they just sort of walk forward and they want to eat you. Or maybe they're really quick and agile, but again, they can't talk, they can't seem to reason, they just want to eat you. And then the other kind of zombie is the sort of android, you know, computer thing that's very sophisticated and can talk and you might mistake for being a person. But which presumably there's nothing it's like to be, because there's nothing it's like to be your laptop. It's just like a rock in that sense. So these zombies, are they, I don't know, where do they fall
they're,
on?
They're them? More like a, yeah, they're more like the first kind. They're sort of almost like a force of nature. The game is set in 1993 in Kentucky, in rural Kentucky, and basically, something has happened, a horrible disease has broken out, and people are now suddenly turning into these kind of mindless flesh-eating beings who wander the earth, seeking nothing but the flesh of the living. And it's a story told almost entirely through little scattered bits of news reports and short TV programs that you see in the background of... Sort of, because at first the world outside of the place you're in hasn't collapsed. And then slowly over time, the thing spreads outside and then eventually the power goes off, the water goes off, and the TV stops working. That's very,
This sounds like home, hey?
that's one of the reasons why I'm recommending it, because, you know, seeing a, you know, kind of breakdown in law and order in real life, it actually makes you think a little bit about these things. You know, zombies obviously not a real thing, but the way that a society can turn sort of anarchic is, I think, very much not a figment of our imaginations.
Yeah. Okay, my recommendation, if you want more reading on zombies, David Chalmers is the leading zombie philosopher, although I think he's wrong because he thinks zombies are a conceptual impossibility in a way. But my recommendation, it's Saturday. If you hear this, watch the Springbok versus British Lions game. If you're hearing this after Saturday, watch the third match in the series. I think that patriotism is profound. I think that our material lives, our civil liberties, and our sort of cultural and community circumstances are only going to be preserved and improved if South Africans enjoy patriotism. We spend a lot of time warning, and I think that this podcast, in a way, is a warning, and one that we've applied the relevant caveats to, not to be too alarmist or anything. And the carrot is also important. It's not just about stick, making this country finally into the great republic that it ought to be. Requires not just stick, but also some carrot. And I think that one of the most living embodiments of that carrot, something that we really can be entertained by and take a shared sense of pride in, is rugby. We were the best in the world. We're currently fighting to maintain that title. And with all the shenanigans off the pitch aside, you know, I think that it's a wonderful test of athleticism and intelligence and team spirit. And I'm looking forward to it myself. And if you're a fan, I'm sure you are too. And if you're not, maybe find a way to have a beer with some people who are fans and see if you can tap into a bit of that spirit. And it's definitely not the only thing. And I don't want to exaggerate its power, but I think fun matters and joy matters.
100%.
So let's enjoy.
Yeah, no, so I'm not a big sports guy. I, you know, barely watch any sports, but I must say that watching the national team play in a good match despite my lack of interest in sport, it can be a truly magnificent experience, particularly when it's with other people who are invested in it. I usually only watch soccer when I have my soccer fan friend.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and it's a different experience.
Yeah, I watched the game last weekend with my lovely lady, and it was just not the same because she's like very analytic and was trying to dissect things, and that's very nice, but it's also really important sometimes to kind of switch off some of the fair and even-handedness and be with someone who's not trying to see, is the ref blowing against us and for us in an irrational way sometimes? And just be like, I don't care if the ref is biased in our favor. That's fine. I just want us to win. it is silly. And it is, it's like dancing, you know, dancing is silly. Sometimes it's a lacquer thing to do.
So, 100% agree with that. When I watch English football with my friend, or rather the English national side playing, he's an England supporter, I always try my best to imitate a completely irrational, lunatic yob who's just mindlessly in favor of of the English team and a shouting
for the
come
TV.
On, England!
It is the safest and most healthy place to take that mood we were talking about, this Führer impulse that we all have of just,
that tribalistic thing that's deep in our brains and is core to our identity. Mm. Anyway.
True love. One true love, and it's the Springboks. They are my love. They are the one. They are the only one.
There you go.
They are the one and only one.
There you go.
Amandla.
All right. And with that, have a wonderful week, and we will see you next week. Cheers, everyone, and keep the flag of liberty flying.